From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Actor Kimberly Williams Paisley has played a lot of roles in her career. The bride in Father of the Bride, the other woman in the hit TV show Nashville. Now she's sharing her real-life role as a daughter in a rough patch of family life, her mother's early journey into dementia. It's a journey many families have shared and will share as baby boomers age. This hour on Point, when dementia hits home, with Kimberly Williams Paisley. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this your family's struggle? Your struggle? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Franklin, Tennessee, is Kimberly Williams Paisley, actor, director, wife of superstar country singer Brad Paisley, mother of two. She's written movingly and with a lot of honesty and detail about grappling with her mother's dementia in the current issue of Red Book. Her essay is at our website, onpointradio.org. Kimberly Williams Paisley, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Describe your mom, Linda, in her prime of life.
My mom was a wonderful mother in so many ways. Very exuberant. I always thought of her as my cheerleader. She was at my soccer games. She was the one who cheered louder than any other mother at the side of the soccer field, sometimes embarrassingly so. She cooked us dinner at night. She made us chocolate chip cookies so we could play bingo around the table after dinner. She was a fantastic fundraiser. She raised a lot of money for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. She raised money for Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She had a way of really engaging with people and championing causes together with people.
You tell a little story about how powerfully empathetic she was, how quick connect she could be. Right at the outset here, this one time when she witnessed a terrible automobile accident.
Yes, I remember I was about 8 or 9 in the car, and my parents both screamed out, and I hadn't seen what happened, but apparently the car in front of our car had hit a little boy. And both my parents jumped out of the car to help. But what my mom did most, she ran to the woman who had been driving the car. And
who hadn't seen the boy who just came out of nowhere to the driver.
Yes, and the boy, thank goodness, was all right. But what strikes me years later is that my mom ran to the person who had committed the crime, so to speak, mm-hmm. even though it wasn't a crime, yeah. It wasn't her fault.
Yeah.
But she embraced this stranger who sunk down on her knees, and my mom got down on her knees with her and just scooped her up in her arms, and they sort of keened and wailed together. Mm. And shared something so traumatic together, but her ability to find empathy with a total stranger is something so beautiful. And something now, you know, years later, she's a different person now, I connect with. She feels like a stranger in some ways, and yet I can wrap my arms around her and we can sort of keen and wail together now in a different way.
Take us back 9 years. Your mom, who had such a vibrant life, was 61. And things began to change. What did she see? What did your dad see? What did you see?
Well, my mom is the one who actually came to us and said, I'm having trouble writing my name on my checks. I'm having trouble adding numbers in my head. I'm having trouble finding words. And at the time, we thought it was stress-related. We thought she wasn't getting enough sleep. My mom had been someone who'd struggled with insomnia from mm-hmm. time to time, and she could get anxious about things. And so it was my mother who had us start looking into it. And now looking back, there were about 2 years before she reached the diagnosis that we can point to where she showed signs of dementia.
Yeah, yeah.
There was increased paranoia. There was an inability to find the proper word and things like that. I think there were slight behavioral changes that we can see now in retrospect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did it frustrate you, those little early signs that you didn't know how to put into context?
Very much. Absolutely. I thought, why is she so upset about this? You know, why can't she get more sleep? Why can't she manage her stress better? And then, of course, it was a period of a month or two, very intense testing that she had to go through with my father. And she was so worried about people finding out that she was concerned about her own issues and problems that they didn't even tell us that she was getting tested. And so when they finally sat us down and told us her diagnosis, it was it hit us pretty hard and felt like it was coming out of the blue.
You'd seen things happening, her handwriting, you say, morphing into choppy, childlike block letters. She couldn't understand mm-hmm. jokes anymore. She would ask your mm-hmm. father to tell her what was funny. And then they acted on their own at first, and the diagnosis came. It was dementia, but not Alzheimer's.
Right. There are many different forms of dementia, and what my mom has is called primary progressive aphasia. It's a degenerative brain disease, and with her, as I said, it first started showing signs with her inability to find the right words and her handwriting. And now, you know, they say that there's a chance to actually it was early Alzheimer's, but it presented itself first as primary progressive aphasia.
Okay.
A lot
mm-hmm.
of these brain illnesses are very similar. Although we have had doctors tell us, you meet one person with dementia, you've met one person with dementia. That there are many different ways that dementia presents itself.
They sat you all down at Christmas in Nashville, 2005. And what did they tell you, your parents, what did they tell you to expect with this diagnosis?
They said that doctors had told them it would be about 5 to 7 years before my mom would need full-time care, which was hard to believe because at the time she was fully functional.
Mm-hmm.
Her, you know, behavior had changed and things like that. She was relying on my dad for some things, but she could take care of herself. So it was hard to imagine it was going to come so fast. And it really has. It has happened exactly as the doctors predicted.
She did not want this to be public. She swore everybody to secrecy. Why? What did she want or not want?
I think she didn't want pity. She didn't want anyone to feel sorry for her. She wanted to keep going as long as she could. And she was able to cover it incredibly well. She was able to laugh even if she didn't know what the joke was.
Mm-hmm.
She'd just be maybe a half a step behind, but she covered, and a lot of people had no idea what she was going through, and she wanted that to continue as long as possible.
And you were covering with and for her many times.
Yes, and that was the most exhausting part of this whole process, is feeling like we were in a black hole that we couldn't tell anybody about, we couldn't share with anybody. It was exhausting trying to protect her pride and not being able to be truthful. It was very hard for myself and my brother and my sister and my father.
You described being in line at Starbucks and your mom calling out that she wanted nachos when, of course, Starbucks doesn't serve. And you all laughing as if it were a joke, but knowing it wasn't. This was a sign of dementia.
Yes, and there were a lot of instances like that. Going to a restaurant was a whole ordeal. Trying to delicately hand her fork as she's trying to eat the food off her plate, her spaghetti with her hands,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
In our house, when she'd come over, I went and had to get a bunch of plastic glasses because she'd broken so many glasses. And not only was it getting rid of all of our glasses, it was dangerous to have broken glass all over the floor. So without saying anything, we all just started drinking from plastic glasses.
Yeah. There was a long then charade here. What brought mm-hmm. that period of this to an end?
Well, we couldn't hide it anymore. There was I remember one specific day she was at the beach and tried to walk back to their house. Was about a maybe half-hour walk. And a friend of mine from high school passed her on the road and offered her a ride. And my mom couldn't tell her where she was trying to go. And things like that started happening more and more. And it just was something we couldn't cover up anymore. And that was a relief. To not have to cover it up anymore and to be able to start talking about it. Because, of course, it wasn't her fault. But I think her disease was making her feel like it was something, her own shortcoming, something that she had done wrong or something that was her fault.
Of course, in your family, as all families, things don't stop happening. You began to build your own family. You've got a baby, then another, young children. As your mom's kind of falling apart, what was that chapter like, Kimberly?
Well, that was a whole other dynamic because I had to protect my own children, of course, first and foremost, but at the same time trying to protect her pride. So when my first son, Huck, was born, my mom really wanted to bond with him and wanted to be able to change his diapers. And I remember one time letting her take him upstairs and then just waiting, yeah, and not wanting to get too involved,
praying,
but also
a
wanting
bit
to make sure, wanting to make sure he's going to be okay. And then I remember my dad and I going in to check, and he was laying down on the changing table, which was good, but she didn't know how to change his diaper. She didn't know what to do. And sort of that laughter and, oh, yeah, no, this is fine, this is easy, here, let me help, and mm-hmm, covering and say, oh, it's no big deal. You know, oh, yeah, changing diapers is tricky. And just swooping in and laughing it off and changing the diaper. But they did bond in a terrific way. On the floor, playing with games, giggling, laughing. I would go upstairs and leave them downstairs playing and hear, yeah, uproarious laughter. And my mom had this energy that I didn't have for a little baby and a toddler. And they really had a special relationship for a long time.
We're going to look at what care ultimately required of you, of your family, your father, and ultimately institutionally as well. But I guess through all of this, you were emotionally evolving yourself.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's been a journey, and we're definitely in a different phase of our relationship now, but I'm learning so much from it. It's healing to talk about it with people. It really is.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about when dementia hits home with actor Kimberly Williams-Paisley. She starred in Father of the Bride, was the other woman in the hit TV show Nashville. She's written movingly about her own mother's journey into dementia and the family's struggle to adapt and deal with that reality. Millions of families are doing that. 2009 HBO documentary series, The Alzheimer's Project. Here's a little bit of that. Marvin Haskell Jr. talked about what it was like to visit his father in the nursing home.
It's very hard for me to see him the way that he is now. And I get myself a little emotional. And if my mother's here, she sees the emotion, that makes it harder on her. So I tend to make an excuse and leave. Or I try to come by when my mom's not here.
Kimberly, may I share a couple stories from our listeners with you?
Absolutely.
They're responding to your story with a lot of candor, the kind of candor that you shared. Kelt writes to us, my spouse's mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's long after we began to notice issues. What we didn't know, Kelt writes to us, was how much my father-in-law was keeping from us about their day-to-day lives, including her filling the trunk of the car every day with belongings and insisting that she be driven home to her childhood home, her becoming combative and verbally abusive. Her husband thought he was protecting her by keeping those things private, but because she was never treated when the final break came, it was a big shock for the family. We're going to talk with your father in a few minutes, Kim, about his beloved wife, Linda, your mom. Here's one more. Bob has been through this, writes to us, been there, done that 3 times so far.
Ooh, wow.
Grandfather, grandmother, and now my mother. Bob writes, my dad bailed with suicide and left me with my mother's care. She's in assisted living memory unit, which has finally given me some peace. Prior to that, it was complete hell, especially with my dad's death thrown into the mix. It was difficult to be a caregiver when you're trying to mourn a death, actually 2 deaths. The mother I knew was gone away too. And it's not cheap, Bob writes. Really, you have to have money to have Alzheimer's in this day and time.
Yeah.
In America. You can hear people responding to your candor, Kimberly. What about care when it came to that? You first brought in AIDS.
We did. We brought in AIDS. And I'm glad that you bring this up about the caregiver, because that is something. I think my dad shielded us from a lot of the truth of what was going on. And I think he sort of lost perspective. He was in survivor mode.
Yeah.
And we noticed that in many ways. We noticed, first of all, we couldn't get him on the phone as easily. And then when we did, it was very surfacey. And we'd always had very deep conversations in my family. And suddenly, we weren't able to do that. We weren't able to relate on levels we always had. He seemed like he was sort of becoming a shell of who he was. And he can tell you about that. But I do think it's important that people focus on caregivers who may not be telling the whole story, who are in their own private hell and can't get out of it and don't know how to get out of it. And yes, also the point about finances. I mean, we tried to hire aides, and ultimately for our family, and it's different for every family, but it was best to put her in a long-term care facility, but that does require money.
Did your dad resist that? Did you?
We all resisted it to a point, and then then finally it was only my dad and my mother who were resisting. But finally, by the end, there was just no question that both of their lives were in danger. We were losing my mom. There was no doubt about that. But we really started to feel like we were losing my dad as well.
One early morning, you described your dad thought he was having a heart attack, just having a panic attack. Mm-hmm. Actress Kimberly Williams-Paisley is with us, wife of Brad Paisley, big country star, big star in her own right. Kimberly, lots of callers for you, and I want to get to a few. Then we're going to hear from your father. We're going to hear from a clinical social worker about this big trend in our country. But first, Amy in Savannah, Georgia. Amy, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Kimberly Williams-Paisley.
Thank you. And hi, Kimberly. Thank you so much for approaching this topic, because my mother died in May, and she had dementia. And I know the hardest thing for me was mourning the loss of the person that I had known, that I had the physical person in front of me, but the spiritual and emotional person was no longer there. And that was really difficult for me to reconcile. And when you were talking about the handwriting changing, my mother had beautiful handwriting. And I remember seeing or getting something from her, and all of a sudden it was block and very scratchy. And I knew something was wrong, but I wasn't really sure what it was.
Right.
And I wanted to deny the fact that something was going on. But I think for me, once I mourned the loss of my mother prior to her being gone, it gave me so much more acceptance and closure that when I was able to be there at the end of her life, I hate to say this, but it was almost a relief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had any thoughts about having to reconcile the fact that your mom is no longer your mom?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how painful that is. And it's just, it's exhausting too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amy, I'm glad you raise it just that way. Kimberly writes at length about this. Kim, what do you say?
Yeah, it was difficult because for a long time, there, I started referring to my mom in the past tense, because to me, she wasn't there. And it was hard for me to go visit her in the home. It was very painful.
Describe one day where you came home after a visit and sobbed so uncontrollably that your whole body was sore the next day.
Yeah, I've never felt that kind of pain. And, you know, in our family, we talk about dementia as sort of like a death by paper cut. It's just like every day, ow, you know, just an everyday pain. But you can't have that closure that comes with death, unfortunately, in a way. And I understand what you're saying when you say it's a relief at the end. But I was able to, I write about this in the Red Book piece, I was able to see her in a new way after talking to a couple friends of mine who had parents with dementia and described a very interesting new relationship that they were able to come to.
What was that
with
like?
Their parents. Mm-hmm. Well, one woman said that she was able to relate to her mom on a more spiritual level. Another woman said that her father had never told her that he loved her when she was growing up. And all of a sudden, in a moment of lucidity at the end of his life, he got on the phone with her and said, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Mm-hmm. And as I heard my friends tell me these stories, one night it just happened that they both were there at this party, I started sobbing and realized I had neglected that opportunity with my mom. I had written her off too soon.
Yeah.
And I needed to go and see who this person was now. And I was able to go the very next day and see her in a new light and just relate to her on an emotional level and sing with her. And music therapy, I found, has been so helpful. My dad has taught me a lot about that, how to relate to her in an emotional way through music and sound.
It's a journey for everybody.
It feels better,
My goodness. Kimberly, please stand by if you'd be good enough. We're going to talk to your dad, Gurney Williams, in a few minutes. But right now I have with us from Chicago, Darby Morehart. She's a clinical social worker, associate professor at the Cognitive Neurology and Alzheimer's Disease Center at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Darby Morehart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've read Kimberly Williams Paisley's essay. I found it really moving. This is a journey that a lot of American families have taken and that many more in one form or another are going to take, Darby.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, I have read the article and just listening to Kimberly now, I'm just so appreciative of how much she is talking about this because it's really raising a lot of awareness and getting the word out because a lot of people are experiencing this and having a lot of difficulty talking about it.
Is there a kind of standard or typical arc of first awareness and then grappling with diagnosis and care, and is there a typical progression, Darby?
Yeah, I'm really struck with how common it is, and especially with someone so young. Kimberly's mother was so young to
61,
start having
to
start having these symptoms. And then the symptoms were also not your typical symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, which is usually memory loss. So it's very, very common, as she described, to kind of think about these symptoms as signs of stress or, midlife crises or just something that, that could be anything but a neurodegenerative disease. And so to go 2 years is quite common to before you actually then get a diagnosis.
It hits home with a lot of people, and they're calling us, and I think they may benefit from your insight, Darby and Kimberly. Karen in Canfield, Ohio. Karen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My parents are in their 80s, and they're still functioning pretty well. They still do most of the things they've always done, and they're people that, are admired by others.
Good for them.
Are still physically look pretty good, and they still do a lot of activities. But over the past year, I want to say, I've noticed changes in my mom. And one of the things is just a general, negativity, I want to say. And she has several times misplaced things and insisted that they've been taken by someone. And just lately, in the last month or two, she has accused one of my siblings. And it's kind of dividing up the family because the other siblings are kind of siding with her and going along with her.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
They don't want to look at the other things that noticeable things that I've noticed.
Right.
And, even that they've noticed.
Karen, let us pick that up right there from a couple of angles. Kimberly Williams-Paisley, first to you, for what it's worth, to Karen in Ohio, you describe your mother going into untypical rages over things sometimes.
Yeah, and not rational and scary, coming out of the blue, things that we didn't understand where it was coming from. And what we saw was this kind of behavior for a couple of years before the diagnosis. So it's hard to say. I mean, there have been plenty of times I feel like I'm losing my mind. Especially being around my mom, I'm thinking, is it happening to me? I think everyone in our families thought that. I couldn't find that word. It must be happening to me. And so I think what you have to see is a period of time, and Darby can talk more to this, but a period of time where symptoms present themselves.
Darby, what do you look for to spot it? How do you?
Well, I think what this caller is saying is that she is actually describing symptoms that are of a dementia nature, and they do need to be evaluated by in a diagnostic center. Aging is the biggest risk factor for dementia, not in Kimberly's mom's case here, but as one gets into their 80s, there's a 30 to 40% chance that you could get a dementia like Alzheimer's disease. So having suspicious behavior, misplacing things, having language changes, those are all symptoms that can be can possibly be of a dementia, but then there are reversible dementias. So you want to get a diagnostic evaluation to make sure that there isn't something metabolic going on that you might be able to reverse.
And Darby, what about this dynamic, which Karen describes, of these new circumstances dividing a family? Is that a common dynamic?
Well, it is a common dynamic. I mean, we are all of us are have these histories within our families of how we relate to one another. And when dementia you can think of this as a crisis in your family. And any crisis has the ability to bring a family closer together, or it can also have a tendency to tear people apart. So if there's any history of sibling conflict or difficulty relating to each other, that can complicate the family's ability to kind of organize themselves around the changes that are happening.
Kimberly, how did that work out in your family, your extended family, your immediate family? I mean, even in your husband, Brad Paisley, how did the tension flow?
I am so grateful for my extended family in this case. My siblings and I leaned on each other heavily. I leaned heavily on my husband, Brad. My in-laws stepped in as grandparents when my own parents could not. So in our case, we really depended on each other. And my mom's sister got very involved. And so I am so grateful for the family dynamic that we had.
Were there times when you were divided over what to do or how to handle things?
Well, yes. I mean, if there was a rift, it was probably between us and our father. Not a rift, but just a disagreement in how to proceed and when it was time for more care and, you know, what the perspective that we had versus the perspective that he had. So that was the most challenging part, was trying to get through to him.
We're going to hear from your dad in just a minute. But, of course, you had to care for him, too.
Mm-hmm. And trying to say over and over, we're worried about you. And this is how the situation is directly impacting our lives. This is the ways that this has hurt all of us. And he needed to hear that over and over again. And he still has a different perspective on it. But I do feel like now we've crossed over, and now we have him back a little bit. And it's such a relief.
Kimberly Williams Paisley has written wonderfully, movingly, about her mother's journey into dementia in an essay in Red Book. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from Franklin, Tennessee. Darby Moorhart is with us from Chicago, clinical social worker at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. In just a minute, Gurney Williams, Kimberly's dad, will join us. Of course, he was on this journey as well. Behind us right here, Kimberly's husband, Brad Paisley, wrote this very romantic song about his wife from the 2009 album American Saturday Night called Then. They've been on a journey. She shares it with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And now you're my whole life. Now you're my whole world. I just can't believe the way I feel about you, girl. We'll look back someday. I thought I loved you, and I thought I loved you.
Ooh. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about when dementia hits home with actress Kimberly Williams Paisley. She's written about her own mother's journey into dementia. Her mother, Linda, 9 years ago, was diagnosed with a rare form of dementia that was thought of then as primary progressive aphasia. She's written about it in a wonderful essay. It's in Red Book. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Very frank, very candid, very honest in a way that would be helpful to anyone whose family is grappling with this. She joins us today from Franklin, Tennessee. Also with us, Darby Moorhart, clinical social worker at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, joins us from Chicago. It was a long road. Kimberly writes about it in great detail, illuminating details, coming to terms with what was going on with her mom and with her dad, who was in the middle of this, of course, struggling to help his wife, to keep the family together. Kimberly's father, Gurney Williams, joins us right now from Rye, New York, a husband of Linda Williams. He's also written about this, three things everyone caring for an aging parent should know, right alongside Kimberly's essay. Mr. Williams, Gurney Williams, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Tom.
Your daughter's really shared a lot here. There was a time when the family was keeping all this secret. Is it a relief to have it out there and helping others at this point, Gurney?
Yeah, it's a completely different feeling about all of this. And I look back because of that, and also hearing Kim talk now, I'm so proud of her for doing what she's doing and grateful. And I think that's the overwhelming feeling I have right now at this point is gratitude for my wife, for a great marriage, which is now 47 years old.
Yeah.
And now for the chance to do just what we're doing right now.
Kim has described what a wonderful mother she had in Linda, and no doubt a wife that you had in Linda as well in her vibrant years. And then we've heard about how this came on. What was the low point for you, Gurney, and when did it begin to turn around?
Well, I think the lowest point of all was the moment when, under considerable pressure from my three great children, grown children, I realized that I had to let go and let others take Linda from this house and take care of her because I really couldn't do it. And they were right. I was fading from their lives and not realizing it. I was the son of a World War II dad at a time when America could do anything, and specifically men could defeat evil empires.
Yeah.
And I thought I could do this alone. And back in the beginning when she was diagnosed, I remember we went home from that bad day in New York and lay down next to each other in a bed and didn't say much, but I do remember in some way saying, listen, I called her Scout, I still do. We're going to get people in the house to help when we need to, and maybe we won't need to, but I'm never going to send you away. And the hardest moment for me was realizing that I couldn't do it. I had sort of failed in
you
my job.
You felt you had failed.
I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was the most difficult thing. It wounded her. It could easily have speeded up the progression of her disease. It was wounding to me. It ripped us apart in a way. And having said that, I've gotten used to holding opposing thoughts in my mind. Yeah. Tom, I would do it again because I had to.
You know, you talk about three ways, you say, in which your sandwich generation children, Kim with us here today, and also Jay and Ashley, you write, Gurney pulled me off the road toward a serious breakdown. And the first one, three ways they helped you deal with this was, you say, they convinced me that I was as much at risk as my wife.
They held a mirror up to me, and I saw myself fading, and I began to see things more clearly, that I was taking for granted certain things as if it were normal to have a wife become aggressive and to hit me and to go into tantrum mode. And I was actually coached by a psychiatrist when that happens, when your wife goes into this tantrum of throwing things and screaming obscenities in the house and all of that.
What did they coach you to do? Yeah.
I was told to be very calm. You don't put gasoline on a fire.
Yep.
Just stay as calm as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. You say when the time came, they did homework for you because it must be overwhelming.
Well, finally, when my mind and heart opened to this possibility, I realized in a way that I had never in almost any realm of my life that I desperately needed help from a lot of people. And all of a sudden, they were there, particularly my three children, but my grown kids, but all sorts of friends came out to help. So then I started opening up, and things changed, and they did homework by checking out places with me where she might go and being with me throughout all that bad process, tough process.
And then maybe the big step, the one that Kim writes about as well, but you write, together we turn from the past toward the future. That must be really challenging when Linda's in this circumstance.
Well, as Kim said, my mom is no longer my mom. My wife is no longer my wife. I came to that realization over the past 2 years, really since she went into this wonderful place where she is now. I began to let go of her, and for the first time, frankly, Tom, I began to feel real grieving. I would find a sock of hers behind a bureau drawer, a dresser, and realize she must have dropped it there before she left. And that was like a hand grenade in the house. Blam! Wow! Yeah. And I would feel for the first time really this deep sadness, at the same time in a way welcoming it. So yeah, we started looking to a new life for all of us, and I particularly began to come out of a hermit phase that I was in, to reach out to people, to realize that there was this world in New York City that I was missing, there were people I was missing, there was life I was missing. And I came into a sort of a blue sky place where I could see her more as, maybe the analogy would be I was a parent to her and am now of a young child. And sometimes she delights me by saying a word. And if she were a child, I'd probably Facebook it, I would say. My kid just took the first step or something. But it's definitely not a relationship with a wife at this point.
Kim, you're listening to all this from your wonderfully warm and eloquent father. You must have watched him struggle with that letting go. And I can imagine mixed feelings in the child of a father who's challenged with letting go of a woman, your mom.
Definitely, and he is so eloquent, and it's wonderful, as you said, Dad, to be at this point where we can talk about all of this so openly and hopefully help others in it. And it is still so beautiful to watch my dad with my mom in the home now, and going in and embracing her and kissing her, and you know, still being her husband, even though the relationship is very different. And I had that experience last time I saw her, just last week, where I sat down on the chair and snuggled with her, and for the first time in a couple years, she actually put her arm around me and patted my arm, and it was just a little hint of that mom coming back out. And yes, holding the two opposing thoughts of this feels like a child, and yet this still feels like my mom. And I'm able to let go, and yet it's still painful when I imagine who she used to be.
Do you remember when you were trying to communicate to your father that he was himself at risk in this? What did you have to say to him to open his eyes to that when it was hard for him, wrapped up in all this care, to see?
Well, we got on the phone with him because we were all in different places, and so that was the only way to do it. Ideally, it would have happened in person, but we scheduled a big conference call with my brother and my sister and all of our spouses, and we each went through, it was sort of like an intervention. We each went through and said, this is what I see in you, and this is how it has impacted my life. And for us, we talked about our kids and the ways that he was a grandfather and not a grandfather, and carelessness that we saw, and ways that we were concerned about our kids when they were around my parents, and ways that we were worried about his health. And he had to hear it from each one of us, and I'm grateful that he did, and has been so kind back to us, because no one took it harder than my dad. No one worked harder than my father did through this whole process.
Darby Morehart, you're listening in Chicago. What do you hear in this family's trial and response?
Well, I'm thinking about all of the families that are experiencing this as well, and hope that they might be listening to them. But one of the things that I'm struck by is one of the hardest things that it seems families are faced with is holding those what you're calling the two opposing thoughts in your head. I think it's probably one of the hardest things to do.
You mean this is my wife or mother, and this is in many ways at some point not the same person anyway.
Right. It's acknowledging over time and accepting this loss of a parent and of a spouse. But at the same time, recognizing that there is still a person there that I love, and I still have a relationship with them, and I carry the history of our relationship together. And there's just something really beautiful about that. And it's just getting to that place of acceptance.
Something within. Sacred right there. So many people responding to this conversation. If I may bring in Angela from New Orleans. Angela, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and Kimberly as well.
Hi.
And Mr. Williams. I struggled with this issue. My mother had Alzheimer's. Her mother had dementia. Her sister had dementia as well. And my mother had it for 22 years. Mm. So to watch your mother die basically is for 10,000 days is like someone taking the picture and just erasing it with a pencil. And so every day a little bit of it gets rubbed out.
Yeah.
And my mother was 62 when she first exhibited this issue, and she died at 84.
Wow.
And definitively it was Alzheimer's because we had a brain autopsy done. But to struggle with that, and when you're young and you, at the time when she was very into the early stages of it, I had young children, a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And you have your children, you're a working mother, and you have your children in daycare. Yeah. And there's always a concern that you have that, you know, you're going to get the call that your children are going to be thrown out of daycare because of bad behavior, they've done something. But you never, ever, ever expect to get that call that your mother is kicked out of daycare because her behavior is beyond what they can handle there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are hard days. Hard days. Gurney, what was your process of recognizing what was going on? Angela describes something being erased little at a time.
Angela's story is very moving to me, and it goes back to the paper cut analogy. Mm-hmm. You're wounded slowly, and at the same time you build defenses so you don't feel things, so that I was constantly engineering, and I'm sure Angela was too. How do you take that call? Your mom's being kicked out.
Yeah.
You have to do something about it. And you can actually retreat into action so that the feelings disappear. And in fact, you can go on thinking that you're just fine when you're not. It's the very length of this that is one of the most tragic and difficult parts, I think. And particularly in Linda's case, with this particular brand of dementia, she knew from the beginning that she had it. It wasn't as if she was denying it.
Right.
She was aware of it. Mm-hmm. And that was true for a long time. I don't think she knows at this point that she has anything like this. But, boy, it goes on a long time.
One more. Karen in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Karen, thank you for calling. What's your story?
Thank you. First, I would like to give a big thank you to the Williams family for telling this story. I was 24 years old when my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 56. We saw symptoms at the age of 54 with no family history. So while I was in the midst of trying to figure out my own life, I was thrown on a roller coaster ride, being an only child as well, with a very small family. It was really my dad and I, and my aunt, who's an LICSW. So we had a very educated family, but the hardest part for us was in 94 was telling that story, being able to destigmatize and not feel ashamed and embarrassed and wanting to hide the disease. What I can say is, although we've been through the aggression, we've been through definitely some hurdles, the relationship I now have with my mom is the most beautiful and precious relationship that I've ever had with my mom and with my dad. It has totally shifted the relationships that I have with them each. And At times I wish she never got the disease, but at times I'm grateful she has it because I've seen such beauty in my parents' marriage. They'll be married 50 years this coming December.
Karen, you've thrown your arms around it in a big way. For those of us who haven't been fully down that road, it's almost hard to imagine, but I guess we can. Forgive me, but our time is short here. I want to bring it back, Kimberly and Gurney, to you. What's the state you've reached at this point with your mom, Kim?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm grateful that she'd got this disease. I'm not at that point. But I will say there have been times that I've seen qualities in her that are expressed more fully now that she has this disease. The inhibitions are gone. This piece of not really having any self-awareness is there. And that's fun. And when, seeing her on the floor with my kids playing with such enthusiasm and joy is something that I'll never forget. And I don't know if she would have been like that had she not gotten the disease.
Gurney, we've only got half a minute here, but what about your relationship with your children, you and Linda's children? What's happened with that through this?
Well, Ashley, my youngest, at one point in that telephone intervention said to me, "Dad, I used to be able to talk to you, and now you're dimming." And ever since Linda moved into a very good place, I think I've turned a little brighter with all of my children and with many people. I think overall, what I feel more than anything is gratitude for my long marriage and huge gratitude for what my grown kids have done, and I'm proud of them.
Gurney Williams, proud dad of Kimberly and Jay and Ashley, husband, proud husband of Linda. Gurney, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Darby Morehart in Chicago, thank you very much for your professional view on all this.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Williams Paisley, who wrote about this so movingly. See her essay at our website, link to it from Redbook. Kimberly, thank you very much for sharing all this with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.